show, SportsNet 590 The Fan. I'm JD Bunkus, Ailish Forfar, Blake Murphy, all on just a couple hours of sleep after watching Team Canada win gold at the Olympics. Our next guest can understand that feeling. He can relate to that feeling. It's a former Maple Leafs captain, franchise leader in goals and points and many other things, nine-time All-Star and Olympic gold medalist, Matt Sundin. Great to have you on. Good afternoon to you, I think.
Thanks for having me, guys. It's fun to be on.
Yeah, especially since you guys just beat Canada at the Olympics, right? Like, you're making those beat ours. And is this why you time this out? Because you rarely do interviews, and then all of a sudden it was very suspicious you agreed to do it at this time.
I didn't know that Sweden was going to win before I agreed to do the interview, to my defense.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I feel like you were trying to put out the good karma, though, you know? You were trying to do the thing like, hey, if I agree to do this for Canada, it'll be good for Sweden overall. This just felt like a little mind game. So, yes, congrats on that. Just quickly, you win that 2006 gold medal. You're second on your team in points. You set up Lidstrom, obviously, for the game-winning goal against Finland. I couldn't help but think about you guys today as we were getting ready for this interview and just what the Olympics meant to you and, yeah, your career overall, watching a second straight Olympics where we don't have pros who are able to go to these games, the best players who dream about it going to these games.
Well, it was a great experience for me, obviously. I played in 1998 in Nagano, and we lost in the quarterfinals. We played in Salt Lake City, where Team Sweden at the time, we had a fantastic round-robbing, actually beating Canada 5-2 with all the superstars representing Canada. So for us, it was a last chance in 06 to win a medal for myself, Niklas Lidström. We're all older, Peter Forsberg and our generation, so all the pieces fell into place 06 for us, and of course it's a fantastic memory and experience as an athlete, and I really believe that hockey needs to expand in the world, and to have the NHL players in the Olympic Games, I think both the NHL and players, obviously the fans, really going to benefit for that. So I really hope that NHL players going to return to the Olympic Games, next Winter Olympic Games.
So there's talk of a World Championships again and trying to create some kind of a tournament for best on best, but do you think that it'll ever be able to replicate the Olympic experience? Like, is there any fear for you that in doing that, the NHL moves further away from moving to the Olympics?
Well, you know, I mean, the former Canada Cup that became the World Cup, I think is a great experience as well. But I think it's tough. As an athlete, the Olympic Games are such a fantastic experience. It doesn't matter if you're an NHL hockey player or any other athlete. So, and like I said, I think hockey, if you look at the whole world, still hockey is a fairly small sport in only certain countries in the world. So the window for hockey to get new fans to show off our great game, I think it'd be... I really hope the NHL player is going to come back. And I think as a player, it's impossible to replace an Olympics experience and winning a medal with the other. If the World Championships had all the best players, yes, that would be great. But still, the Olympic Games is another level, I think, and weighs a little bit more if you're an athlete.
Yeah, I hope they go back. I just watching our women's team win yesterday and... no offense, hey, congrats to Sweden. It was a good win. But watching a version of Team Canada that could barely get a shot on net was hard for me as a Canadian to swallow. It was really not what I wanted to see for the Olympic Games. So I assume, Matt, that you're in Sweden right now. If you are, it's 1 o'clock in the afternoon. You're such a man of mystery now. Like, it's crazy because in Toronto, you're still one of the most famous people alive. Like, if you walk around in Toronto, it's like still Bieber and then you. And, like, it's a very short list of just noticeable guys, right? Especially since, you know, you're a tall guy, you stand out. It's just, who knows? You could never live here and be in peace. Like, I know that's understandable, but... How closely do you track this Leafs team? Like, do you watch them? They're on such weird hours for you guys. How are they, just even like the connection with you and the team, how are they in your orbit as a person right now?
Yeah, well, of course. I mean, I'm a Maple Leaf fan. They're rest of my life. I have the city of Toronto and my experience, the organization, the Toronto Maple Leafs, to thank for the best years in my life. First of all, you know, I have three young kids now, so most of the time I spend driving around like all parents do when you have, you know, I have a daughter who's 9 years old. I have two boys, 7 and 5. So that takes up a lot of my time. And with the COVID situation, usually I'm in Toronto 3-4 times a year. I have a lot of friends. I have some other engagements there. So hopefully when this pandemic finally ends, I'm going to be able to come into Toronto a lot more. And I consider it still my second home. You know, I feel as home in Toronto as I do living in Sweden. So I'm looking forward to be there more. But it's been crazy busy as a parent. I tell my wife, it's harder life now than when you're playing in the National Hockey League, being the captain for the Toronto Maple Leafs. But you know, I love it. But it's tough as well.
Yeah, I think that a lot of parents just heard you say that and related to you, Max. I think that a lot of parents during the pandemic, and you, just about everyone related to you, where you go, oh, right, you don't get to go to the places you want to go to during the pandemic. Oh, yeah, maybe that's part of the reason we haven't seen Matt Sundin, is there's been a global pandemic that's kept you out of the country for a couple of years. But you mentioned being the captain of the Toronto Maple Leafs and some of the, like, comparing it to how difficult it is now. And this group, right, this team, This version of the Leafs,
yes,
there is just an immense amount of pressure on them right now. I know it's different to compare eras because of social media and what that means versus your era where there wasn't that. But also I think that you had bigger audiences, that it was a more captive audience. I think that hockey just meant more to the city at that time overall, just because there was less to watch. There was less to pay attention to distract you with. The Leafs were just everything, right?
Yep.
So I think it is still fair to compare pressure, right? And obviously when you came to the team, you were traded for one of the franchise's most popular players ever, so you probably felt pressure just immediately out of the gate to perform. But I wonder if you see these guys right now and what they're going through with their lack of playoff success, their inability to kind of get over this hump, and how you relate to it and how you compare the pressure of your tenure with the Leafs.
Yeah, and I mean, you're right. It's really hard to compare different eras in any, in life and in sports especially, because the game changes, you know, with social media and everything. It's a more complex society today. But, you know, I'm a Leaf fan. I think for the Leafs as an organization, you look at this team that the Toronto Maple Leafs have right now, they have a young, and, you know, I wouldn't trade, you know, the core of the Toronto Maple Leafs for any other core. You look around the league, the Toronto Maple Leafs going to have chances to win a championship the next, 10 years, 15 years, by keep building and keep improving. And you look at the season they're having right now, they're if not the most exciting team to watch. So I'm very, very optimistic of what the management of the Toronto Maple Leafs have done to build this young core of great players, and the playoff success is going to come. You know, we let these players mature and also lose a couple of times in the playoffs, and they'll learn how to be successful and start winning in the postseason as well.
Mats, you said you wouldn't trade any of this core for anything. What about if Austin Matthews continues rising up the all-time franchise goal-scoring leaders? Because he's at, I think, 230, 231 now, and he's still pretty young. So you think about trading him as he closes in on your record there, Mats?
You know, yeah, exactly. I hope he breaks my record as soon as possible. But, you know, it's fantastic to see Austin and Mitch Marner and Tavares and Nylander, and it's a great mix, and not only having to lean on one guy. You know, the Toronto has what all great franchises that have won championship in the past also does. There's a great balance in the roster of who should contribute with the offense and taking care of defense together. So really great to watch his development, but the whole group too, how they feed off each other.
Yeah. I mean, he got to start his career here too, right? You're the Nordiques.
Yeah.
You'd have had more.
But,
it would have been more if you...
I had, but Hopefully it's going to take him a while to get to 564, though. You know, if you look at the other two. I mean,
Okay, so speaking of 500, Sidney Crosby just scored his 500th, right? So any excuse to get you to remember yours, right? The hat trick, the OT walk-off against Calgary. let's just tell us about it, man. Just let me just hear you talk about that moment.
I'm getting so old, I almost keep forgetting here. But the unique thing, I guess, was that it was a very back and forth game against Calgary, I remember, and scoring my hat trick, playing 3-on-4, I think it was shorthanded. It was a hat trick, and it was also my 500th goal. So the combination of that, I think, was very unique. And you know, there's rarely you score when you're playing a 3-on-4 on the ice in hockey. So it was very special. And be able to do it at home, you know, in our own building and have the home fans. And it's a great memory for me. And my kids nowadays ask me sometimes, well, none of them were born when I play the game. But obviously they catch up. So, and nowadays with internet, they can see some of the highlights from back then. But it's something I'm very proud of. Was able to do in representing the Toronto Maple Leafs. That was great memories.
It's one of the greatest memories all Leafs fans have. I wish we had a cup, but that is really the one of our championships in
it's
this
coming.
City.
You it's coming. It. It's
I,
coming.
I hope so, man.
It's coming.
I hope so. I hope so. I want to see you on a parade float in the city someday. That would just be really great. I want to, like, I'm guessing that after you had that hat trick, that you popped a few bottles, that you had a few drinks. Like, when you scored that 500th goal, I want you to basically replicate whatever night you had times 10 celebrating a Stanley Cup with the Toronto Maple Leafs. I think that would be...
And, I mean, you guys know. I mean, I remember when we play the playoff games and this team is going to do that, you know, they're going to start winning in the postseason. When we won in the first round, whether it's game one or game two, I mean, you guys know, Yonge Street, it was like a Stanley Cup parade for every playoff game that we won in the playoffs. And it created so much energy in the city of Toronto and for us as players, it was almost overwhelming. Listen, it's just one game. We've got to win another 23 or whatever in the playoffs. But, I mean, it's really fantastic to experience that. And those are my strongest memories for being a Toronto Maple Leaf player, to experience, the level of excitement and passion that the city of Toronto has for the Maple Leafs. So I'm so thankful that I was able to be there for all those years and experience that.
So, speaking of all those years and just remembering that and experiencing that, I keep trying to look back at the comparables between you guys and what's happening now. And, yeah, like, you guys obviously were going deeper in the postseason, but it just felt like, hey, can we get over this hump, right? You get to a conference finals. You've won a couple of rounds. Yeah. You can't do it. You're trying to do this. You're trying to get back over the well. How do you manage just regular seasons, especially as a leader of a team, when you know that everyone in the city is used to you having regular season success now, and everyone knows that it becomes this goal of trying to win a Stanley Cup, but not just trying to win a Stanley Cup. Like, you didn't play for the Arizona Coyotes, you know? Like, you played for a place where there were Stanley Cup parades, like you just said, for playoff rounds. And just the pressure and the weight of that, trying to manage that throughout the course of an 82 regular game season where you're just trying to get to the spot so that you can prove that you can get over the mountaintop again.
Well, you know what? It's really, for this group that Toronto has right now, it's nothing. I mean, you look at the Detroit during their era when they had some great teams. You look at Tampa nowadays. All the great teams, yes, they finish top five or most of them even top one or two or three in the regular season. And why is that important? Because once the playoffs starts, this area, Toronto Maple Leafs, are already showing they're a top team in the league, and you're going to play the same teams in the playoffs. So it's just a little mental hurdle to get over, to feel that we're going to be able to play the same hockey once the playoff starts. Don't try to make anything harder. Don't change your game. Yes, the game's going to be a little more intense, But we can handle that because we're facing the same guys. Most of them we've been beating all regular season. So it's, I think many times there's a little misconception there. It's about doing the same thing that makes you win in the regular season. Be able to do that once the playoff starts. Yes, it's a little more hostile environment. Yes, the intensity is up a little bit. But bottom line, you have the tools already there to win. And you're beating the teams in the regular season, and you're facing the same guys in the playoffs. So this team's going to figure that out, and they're going to be able to bring playoff success.
Matt, this is so great that you've come on the show today. It's especially sweet because we have a guy on our show later today named Nick Kyprios. He also has a show here. You know, he's a little sour. You know, you choosing the big show over his show. It feels good, though. we'll say hi to him for you later today. We'll pass along any messages that you have for him now.
You can also tell Nick that I remember when I started my career with the Quebec Nordiques, we played the Hartford Whalers, and Nick Kyprios was on the other team, and he was really hard on me from the other bench. You can tell him that. It kind of gave me a spark to get better, but he was one of the worst agitators just by mouthing off all the time when I played him.
Well, I'll let him know that's part of the reason why you chose to do our show instead of his. Matt
Sundin. Exactly.
It was a real pleasure, man. Thanks so much for making time for us. Go Leafs, go.
Thanks for having me, guys. Have a great day.
See you, Mats. The captain. Captain Clutch. Matt Sundin. Yeah, that goal, I can't wait to talk to Kipper about it. I know he listens. And
oh,
so,
he's sitting there just...
Oh, he's sour.
He's fuming.
He's trying to think back to the bench now, those moments in Hartford. And he's like, what did I say that Mats won't do my show? And you know, Kipper probably said so many offside things over the years.
Well, you think? I thought he was probably really polite and gentle.
Kipper, it's not your fault. It's not your fault, buddy. He just wanted to do the big show, all right? He just wanted to do the big spot. He wanted to do the show. He wanted to come on. I got to say, like, having it happen the day after the Olympic gold, but also for Sweden's Olympic win, I really do feel like our producer, Daniele, what a get, Daniele. Because that's the crazy thing about Mats Sundin is, and I know that the pandemic and his answer is correct, but he's such a – it's not – common when you have that kind of clout in a city and you're not as attached to the city, right? Like, think about the amount of commercials, for example, like Joe Carter had here, or the amount of presence that some other players like Wendell Clark, who he was traded for, have here, where it just, you know, you can talk to Wendell Clark if you work in media. We've had Doug Gilmore be around this franchise for a very long time, but Mats is sort of the guy where you always wonder, what's he up to? Every once in a while, you see him in a poker commercial, like, or a poker tournament. It's like, that's it. And then, yes, the appearances in Toronto, he does show up here, but you always wonder, hey, like, what's the connection? So it did feel great to know that he is still tracking these guys, that he is still watching, and that he does still feel that deep connection to that team in the city. I will admit, like, it felt great. It felt great to hear him say those things.
He's such a great ambassador for the team and the sport as well, and just what it means, and to have that, like, obviously his perspective as one of the greatest Maple Leafs ever, and when you factor in longevity, like, very much in the conversation. I don't know. It's awesome to hear from him and hear how someone with that stature and who's meant that much to the sport in this city feels similarly to how we're all feeling. You know, it gives you a little bit of affirmation that, maybe not affirmation, but lends a little more confidence that things are on the right track, and some of these anxieties are just those, because, you know, someone who's been through it and not gotten over the hump sees, you know, where the growth is coming.
So how would you guys rate my fanboyness there? Did I keep it professional or what? Tall, I said go Leafs go.
I thought you did a great job, JD. I know it was hard for you to hold it in. And I can see the little grin on your face and your eyes
Mats
lighting up when he laughed at your jokes. You took it to heart. And then he laughed at Blake's jokes, and you were like, okay, he laughs at everyone's jokes. But it was special. I felt the connection. Okay. You know, I think he really does like you.
now I'm heartbroken that I forgot to tell him the story, although he probably wouldn't have cared. But once went to a Pittsburgh Penguins game in Pittsburgh, and my dad was a very big guy. He was like 6'4", and he would just do these really weird things. And one time we were there, and he just walked onto the Maple Leafs bus saying he was Matt Sundin's cousin. And this is something that you'd never get away with now. But my dad, this is like, I want to say 2005, 2006, on the road. Yeah, just goes past security with confidence, big tall guy. He's like, oh, I'm Matt Sundin's cousin. I'm his cousin. And they just ended up letting him through till he's on the bus. And then some of the players are like, who the is that guy? And ends up, Matt's did not corroborate my father's story that he was his cousin, and they ended up escorting him off of the team bus.
That's amazing.
Like, yeah. So no, but that was very much like a family favorite was Matt Sundin, I think, for a lot of players. And so, yes, I want kind of this. I'm gonna keep this going, Blake. I think it's a good idea to keep this something to chew on Matt Sundin.
Yep.
Because yeah. It's time for something to chew on, brought to you by Great Canadian Meats.
Yum, yum, yum.
Yum, yum, yum. I don't think Matt Sundin gets enough credit as a trailblazer. And that's a weird thing to say when we talk about a guy who played for a major market for a really long time. Like, he truly is one of the most famous players to ever play the game, right? Like, if you just think about mm-hmm. hockey and its peak, and like this is why I think it is fair to compare social media era to Matt Sundin's era. Is like, go watch highlights of those games and go look at what the Leafs crowds look like and what the streets look like and what the newspaper coverage was like. It's just that guy, if you think that John Tavares has trouble walking through Toronto, no, Matt Sundin actually would have. This is a different era that we're talking about here. And I know that it just happened very, very quickly overnight, but man, just the amount of pressure and the amount of media scrutiny and coverage that this guy got, you would think, how could he be overlooked? Matt Sundin was the first European player to be selected first overall. He was the first European player to be named captain. And if you look at that team, that 2006 Sweden team, because I was just thinking about this last night as looking at that roster. He was the captain of a team with Nick Lidstrom and Peter Forsberg. Like, Alfredsson was on that team. Go through that roster, that Swedish roster, and Matt Sundin was their captain. He was just one of the most universally respected guys in the game. Captain clutch. Obviously someone who just completely closed games. But when we talk about, hey, who framed viewing European players differently? A lot of times we always focus on Pavel Bure and Russian-born players and their escape from Russia. And rightfully so. This isn't to take away or discredit anything those guys did. It's insane to think about escaping the Kremlin at those times and trying to play hockey in North America and, mm-hmm. and achieve your dreams. Completely different story. But Matt Sundin, in terms of the way that we in North America looked at players from Europe, he's a trailblazer. He really is. And I really don't think that we ever focused on that element of his career enough. And especially now where we really do look back at people who change things in games. Like, we do things like, hey, hockey is for everyone. Hockey is a more inclusive sport. Hey, hockey should be more welcoming. I really do believe Matt Sundin had a massive impact on that. Like, being the face of the Toronto Maple Leafs for that long is monumental and under-discussed.
I agree completely, and I think another part of it too is, like, you mentioned Bure, and you can extend it to McGilney or Solani or whatever.
Sure.
And a lot of European players had the reputation of having one way to play, right? It was a lot of flash. It was a lot of offense first. It was a lot of goal scoring. And Sundin is this 6'5", 230 centerman who's also beast. Good in his own zone and is a very good face-off guy and, you know, is playing in three zones and playing in all situations. So, you know, I don't really remember what the discourse around hockey was like in the mid-90s, other than, like, hey, Matt Sundin's awesome and he's my favorite player kind of thing. But I imagine that a guy like that, to your point, being the captain in the face of the Toronto Maple Leafs, but also playing what narrow-minded people might call, like, a more traditional North American style of game, was helpful as well in terms of breaking down that, you know, that stereotype of what a European hockey player at a top level looks like.
Also, that trade is just so stupid. Wendell Clark, Sylvain Lefebvre, and then a lower draft pick. The Leafs got a higher pick with Sundin.
Yeah, the old pick swap.
Yeah, they pick swapped and they got a higher pick to get Matt Sundin. Imagine that too. Dude, if there was Twitter after the Matt Sundin trade with how mad people were,
it would have crashed.
Yeah,
goated.
But I'm saying so many people would have had to delete tweets because Toronto market was furious with that. Listen, my dad loved Matt Sundin, but one of my earliest memories was like sports memories of, you know, older guys talking about sports was my dad and his friends talking about how could you trade Wendell Clark? Like, how could you ever trade Wendell Clark? And so, yeah, I think that if there was Twitter, there was social media, it would be the all-time old takes exposed in terms of getting something wrong. Like, truly, it would be one of the greatest, one of the absolute greatest. Let's take a break and shift into something less exciting than Matt Sundin, which is thinking about baseball and where we're at with baseball right now.
The lack of baseball. Here's 90 minutes on one of the greatest nights in Canadian women's sports history and talking to Matt Sundin. And then we've got a ton more of that later, like the whole second half of the show. Let's just drop in half an hour of labor.
CBA. Woo.
Get your pocket protectors ready, nerds. It's my time for a second.
Here's the thing, though. You know what scares me? And this is the way that I'll pitch it in to Blair as the tease is – we're busy right now with our sports calendar. The Raptors got sneaky hot. The Maple Leafs are always huge. Team Canada just won a gold medal. We've been busy. The NFL just concluded. There's been the Super Bowl. The season extended longer than normal, right? But baseball just feels forgotten. And we're the city that cares about baseball right now. Like, if you look at the biggest baseball markets in all of North America, the people who are actually the most excited for baseball, Toronto is in the top 10. There's no doubt about it. We're the crown jewel where young people care about the baseball team here. This is not just a...
And, like, the franchise that, like, from a non-fan perspective, at least in the top three in terms of, hey, if there's a labor stoppage or this eats into the season, you are losing out. Like, you've already lost a partial season of this extremely young core that's so exciting, so good before they hit free agency and stuff like that. And now you're going to miss out on even more of that. And if I'm like, look, I'm not apathetic about it. I really want baseball back. I would like that. If I'm Major League Baseball, and I know they don't think about this because we have decades of evidence that they just don't care about fans or the long-term health of their sport. It's not the resentment and the anger this is causing that's worrying me. It's the apathy. It's the fact that you're in a labor war, and if this were the NBA or NHL or, oh my God, if it were the NFL, this would be a lead the show every day issue. And if you're baseball right now, you're an afterthought because everyone just kind of chirps you and rolls their eyes at your negotiation stuff. We're going to talk to Jeff Blair, co-host of Blair and Barker and columnist for Sportsnet.ca, about the MLB situation after the break. Stick around with us. We got Kiprios at 8. We'll do a little wake and rake, and then Cheryl Pounder and Jen Botterill in the 9 o'clock hour to continue soaking in that gold medal win for the Canadian Women's National Team. All that's next on The Fan Morning Show, Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Breaking down everything in Leafsland better than anyone. Real Kipper and Bourne. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Fan Morning Show. Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Blake Murphy, Alex Forfar, JD Bunkus. Subscribe to the podcast, wherever you get your podcasts. The Fan Morning Show. Give them a follow at JD Bunkus, at Ailish Forfar. If you missed it, not only were we celebrating, especially Ailish celebrating, Canada's gold medal victory last night in women's hockey, earlier on, we just had Matt Sundin on, and JD is still just like, so we're on Zoom while we do this remotely, and there is just like a haze around JD right now. It just like his aura
he's blushing.
Is glowing. Yeah. From that Matt Sundin interview. it's hard for me to get that kind of feeling from an athlete, but buddy, you want to get into the weeds of a collective bargaining agreement, you're gonna see see my aura shining. We're joined now by Jeff
Blair's
Blair.
Guy would be
we'll ask him in a second.
Ask him.
Jeff Blair, co-host of Blair and Barker, columnist for sportsnet.ca. Jeff, good morning, man. How are you?
I'm really good. How are you guys?
Doing well.
Oh, honestly, I could not be better. I'm having the best day of my life. Like, yeah, just endless happiness over here.
I was just surprised to see Canada. I was surprised to see Canada and the U.S. in the gold medal final. So
it was shocking, honestly. Yeah. You know what? But strange things can happen in sport. That's the beauty of it. So I'm glad that we got to see something so, you know, random, really random.
I mean, one thing about, you've got to say this. And I know people get into, I don't want to get into the whole debate about whether or not women's hockey belongs in the Olympics or anything. It's a silly argument. It belongs in the Olympics. I don't even know why people feel they have to mention it. But, I think there's some issues with growing the game in other countries, obviously. Mm-hmm. You see that. But, man, I don't know. I don't know if there's another sport where two teams consistently deliver drama.
You're right.
The way those two, and it's not, and I'm, yeah, it's, I'm happy Canada won the gold medal, but it's just the drama of it. You know, everything, it's not even a sports, it's like a soap opera. And I mean that in a good way. It's like the 15th, I don't know, the 15th follow of a great movie that just continues to get good. And yeah, it's fun. And it's the highlight of the Olympics, man. The Olympics needed that. I think
big
they did. I'm sure folks in the U.S. don't feel that way. But for Canada, you know, and this is based on the TV viewing numbers as well, man, the Olympics needed that. They really did.
Well, Jeff, did you see the Natalie Spooner quote before the game?
No, which I did not. What'd she say?
She said we want to embarrass them, and every opportunity we get...
prove that they shouldn't be on the same ice surface, yeah.
Ice surfaces. That's healthy. Like, that's before that gold medal. But that's what I'm saying is, like, when you're talking about drama and it being a soap opera, like, find me another athlete or another sport right now where they're openly saying something like that before a big game about their opponent. Like, that's just not 2022 sports.
Oh, God, you're not getting that. No, no. Can you imagine that in the NHL? Could you imagine Austin Matthews saying before the, you know, well, the Leafs are never going to be in the final. Bad example. Could you imagine Sidney Crosby saying that about somebody on the Vegas Golden Knights before the Stanley Cup, before the final or something like that? I can't wait to. I hope we can embarrass the hell out of the Golden Knights. I'm so looking forward to rubbing their face in it. You'd never get that.
No, the closest we got was like the Crosby-Ovechkin pseudo-rivalry where you never really got the impression that Crosby cared all that much, and the marketing was all like, ha, ha, ha. Exactly. Like, aren't they so different? Okay, so Jeff, we're going from one of the best soap operas in terms of the Canada-U.S. women's hockey rivalry that would have infinite seasons, it would be bingeable wherever you binge, all that stuff, to a soap opera that would be canceled after like two episodes the MLB and the MLB Players Union. We were kicking this around a little bit before we brought you on. And if I'm Major League Baseball, and I'm not because I actually like the sport and would like to see baseball this year and would like to see the sport do well, the biggest thing that is worrying me right now is not that there's resentment from your fan base. It's not that people are annoyed at this. To me, the worst sign if I'm baseball is the level of apathy this is all being met with. Do you feel similarly like that? Worse, pitchers and catchers are supposed to report this week, and it's a story, but there's so much else going on in the sports world that it's not really a story, the level of, hey, one of the major sports is having a labor lockout. I think that's a bad sign for baseball.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think in the long term, look, I mean, this is the sixth time that I've heard people say that baseball is dying because of the CBA. It doesn't work that way. The way the sport is going financially, you know, attendance is going to be less and less important. Whether or not fans come out to the ballpark is going to be less and less important. The money's in the TV, the money's in streaming, and the real money ultimately is in online gaming for baseball. It's unfortunate, but you know, I hear fans on social media, well, I'm not going back to the ballpark. Well, you probably will, but 4 or 5 years down the road, it's not that baseball won't care if you're there, but if you're not going to the ballpark and sing at home and gambling on each pitch, baseball will take its share of that, and they'll be quite happy. So, I think more than anything else, and you are right, the even amongst baseball people, you know, the reaction is, yeah, well, okay, maybe miss spring training, and yeah, maybe the regular season starts a week late. I think the issue for baseball is people are just tired of BS. Like, after what we've been through for 2 years, we just don't have time for BS. And you're seeing that in the Olympics, right? I mean, with the Russian figure skating, we don't need that. After what we've been through for 2 years, we need stuff to be a little less complicated. You know, we need people we can cheer for. You know, we need people that we can dislike. We just need to get back to the basics. And I think you're seeing that with sports fans. And as a result, I think people are just, you know, kind of shrugging and saying, yeah, okay, well, get back to us when you guys finish figuring out how to split up $11 billion. And, yeah, we might be a little pissed off at the beginning, but that July afternoon at the Rogers Center with the roof open, there'll be people back.
Yeah, how to chop up 11 figures is not exactly front of mind in terms of what what's important. I do think, though, there are some – I don't want to go too deep on this with you, but I do think that there are some economic issues at play here that go beyond just, like, the financial health of baseball or what revenues are going to look like. And obviously franchise values are going through the roof and revenue is outstripping the growth in the competitive balance tax and things like that. But I do look at a couple other – elements here, and I see MLB's desire to shrink the minor league pool and not come around very much on minor league player pay, in addition to cutting out some of those spots. And then I look at some of these, you know, some of these communities that have given tax dollars to, hey, hosting a spring training site and stuff like that. And those are two different things, but I do think that there's an apathy from baseball side towards it's more grassroots elements where, hey, if you keep shrinking minor league jobs and you keep saying there's only money here for the top 1%, at least domestically, I think you're only exasperating the issue that baseball's slowly become a sport of privilege domestically, where like a lot of these big scout tournaments are pay to play and stuff like that.
Right.
And then you have these smaller communities that rely on baseball to drive, you know, drive the economics of the community, and they're being forgotten about as well. So I would be concerned, and tell me if you disagree, but there's a long-term health component here that MLB is maybe being short-sighted with.
Yeah, you hit in a good point about the spring training facilities. You know, we do tend to roll our eyes. Oh, okay, well, God, players are only going to have 3 weeks to get ready instead of six. Yeah, you know, it's amazing because every spring, one of the stories you end up writing, and it's usually in one of those days where not much is going on, you get a player who says, God, spring training's just way too long. You know, let's cut it down to 3 weeks. And then, of course, when you're faced with a situation like the lockout, everybody says, well, no, we need a month of spring training to get ready for the game. And I think what we do tend to lose sight of is the importance of the revenue generated by spring training games in those communities. And you're absolutely right. In a lot of cases, they've put in special taxes, or in the very least, they've tapped into their tax base, their available tax base to get the stadium built. The minor leagues are a little more problematic, and it kind of gets to something that Greg Boris, who is the former communications director for the Players Association, told Barker and myself yesterday in our pod, which I found really interesting. I think the rate of change in baseball over the last 5 years has been so fast that the CBA and other aspects surrounding how the game is governed, it just hasn't kept up with it. And I think you can look at that, and you can look at the minor leagues and say, okay, how surprising should this be? First of all, baseball is the only sport, for the most part, that has to develop its own players, right? It doesn't have the college hockey system or the junior hockey system to develop players. Yeah, guys go to college to play baseball, but when they come out of college, they still need to be developed. So very rarely do you get a guy coming right out of high school, right out of college, and he's a star. You just don't get that. So baseball has had to assume the costs of developing its players. And what we've seen happen over the past 5 years, the Blue Jays are part of this, the development of these very scientific, very focused, centralized training facilities for players. Like, I think we'll eventually get to a point where there will be very few minor league teams, because I just don't think I think the training will be so good. You will be able to draft the guy. You'll be able to put him into one of these complexes. You could have, you look where the Blue Jays are in Florida. You have, what, 6-7 teams within an hour's drive of each other, or 2 hours drive, 3 hours drive. You can put all your players in one complex. You can have the Jays 20-year-old players playing the Yankees 20-year-old players. You can do that without necessarily needing a minor league system, because you don't need, with all due respect to minor league teams, the Jays generally don't need, what, 15 of the guys in their AAA roster aren't going to make it to the majors in a year. So what's happened is it's almost as if the game has changed too rapidly to keep up with some of its, you know, some of its supports, right? And I think we saw that with the last CBA. As Greg Boras said, the minute the ink was dry in the last CBA, it was outdated. And Blake, this is in your wheelhouse. 10 years ago, 11 years ago, 12 years ago, you could get in a fist fight in a press box by talking about war. The old guys would say war is irrelevant. It's a made-up stat, and it's silly, and blah, blah, blah. Now we're at the point where the players and owners have actually kind of come to an agreement that they're going to use war as a measure of how much money you make. Think about that. That is, 10 years ago, that would have been an outrageous suggestion. So I guess what I'm getting at, the long answer, is I don't know how baseball reacts to this, because the analytical change, the technological change, what we know about fitness, all that stuff, it's just going so rapidly that my fear is that at some point baseball, it's not that it's going to grind to a halt, but at some point it's just going to need to reexamine how it does everything. And I don't mean that through a CBA. I mean, you're going to have to get players, owners, other people together and say, where are we going with this? Because we need to get a handle on how all of this change is affecting our game. And I think we're seeing that with this CBA. I mean, there's a lot of really granular things that need to be addressed with this. And you know, that's what kind of what worries me as we sit here on what, February 19th or whatever it is. That's what really worries me, is I'm beginning to think that there's almost too much for these guys to do. There's almost too much for them to think about, let alone come to an agreement on.
So, Jeff, if pitchers and catchers had reported this week, there's probably a lot of different stuff we'd be – well, there is a lot of different stuff, not probably, we'd be talking about. One of the things that we could talk about still, but is probably going to be a conversation point until it's done, is what the contract situation looks like for a guy like Vlad or a guy like Bo once we know the parameters of the new CBA. And I think that we got a little bit of a signal to that this week when it was reported that Juan Soto turned down a 13-year, $350 million contract. Now, maybe some of that is, hey, you need to wait and see what the new economic environment of baseball looks like before you agree to a 13-year deal. Like, you just mentioned how quickly things have changed in the last 10 years. Like, do you want to lock into economic certainty 13 years out? But also, maybe that's a sign that a guy like Juan Soto feels his price is higher than that. Do you look at that as a comparable for a Vlad and, to a lesser extent, Bo, and see that as a number that's on the Toronto Blue Jays radar once we get all this other stuff figured out?
I mean, I think you have to. I think you have to look at that. You have to look at Fernando Tatis Jr., and you have to look at Wander Franco and look between the two extremes, right? The Rays contract to Wander Franco after, you know, very, very, very early in his career. And then I would still use Tatis Jr. maybe as a measuring stick more than Soto. Certainly for Bo Bichette, I think a year away from now, well, I'm sure Vladdy's people will tell you right now that Soto's contract is a measuring stick for him. But look, I've kind of said all along, at some point, one of these guys is going to be making, at least one of them, is probably going to have a contract with the Blue Jays if they want to keep him here for the long term. That's going to be paying him someplace in the neighborhood of $400 million. I mean, cool. That's just kind of the way it's going. And whatever happens with the CBA, I know one thing won't change. The dudes at the top end are still going to get top end money. Yeah. I mean, that stays the same throughout every CBA. The guys in the middle, they'll probably end up getting screwed as they always do. The guys on the lower end, the pre-arb guys, it looks like they're going to make more money whenever this is settled. But the guys like Vladdy and Bo, they're going to get what they're going to get. And at some point, yeah, the organization has to sit down and say, okay, we've got these two players. You know, what are we looking at? Are we going to be looking at $350 million for Vladdy, $300 for Bo? I don't know. $400 for Vladdy, $300 for Bo. We're talking about a half $1 billion plus for two players. And there will be, you know, there will be that moment where that decision, that discussion has to be held. And I'll be flat out honest with you. And I'll give the Blue Jays credit for this. I don't think anybody has an idea how much has been talked about, whether or not it's been talked about. Bo's kind of tipped his hand a little bit. He did last year before spring training that there were some discussions. But one of the other things at work here is, with all due respect to these two guys, neither of them come from families that need the money. I mean, this is the other thing with Bo and Vladdy. You're talking second generation major league players whose parents made a ton of money when they played, so they're not going to offer a discount. You know, this isn't Ronald Acuna Jr. or Ozzie Albies offering the Atlanta Braves a huge discount because they want to feed their families. These are kids from families that are well off, whose fathers know their way around the game. And they're gonna get every last cent out of the organization. So, yeah, I think once the game gets back, you know, I would expect you would hear that the Blue Jays are going to have discussions during spring training with one or both of these guys about a long-term contract. My sense tells me that this ownership will pony up. But man, that's a lot of money. That is a great, great whack of money for one organization to have to pay out.
Yeah, it certainly feels like we're heading toward a bit of a Stars and Scrubs pay era in baseball, if it's not already to that degree, to use a fantasy baseball auction term. Jeff Blair, co-host of Blair and Barker, columnist for Sportsnet.ca. Thanks so much for taking the time this morning, man. And hopefully next time we have you on, we have some actual, you know, spring training stuff to talk about, some actual baseball instead of theoretical financial baseball.
Yeah, that would be great, wouldn't it? Thanks a lot.
Yeah. Thanks, Jeff. Jeff Blair, co-host of Blair and Barker, Sportsnet.ca. Yeah, Vlad, Bo, look at 13 years, $350 million that Juan Soto was like, nah, that's fine. And then,
it's
a tough one. Yeah.
Yeah. CBA talk is boring to me, but hearing Blair do that, I'm like, oh, I want to hear more Blair.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing with the CBA talk every time is like, I can appreciate the negotiation and the specifics and the nerdery of it all, but at the end of every conversation, I'm just like, damn it, just give me baseball back. Like this is supposed to be post NBA trade deadline. This is supposed to be what carries me to the playoffs now. And I know that in this job, I have hockey now as well. And we got an NHL trade deadline and all that stuff. But man, this is supposed to be the little gap baseball fills before March Madness picks up and before the playoffs pick up. Drop the ball here, baseball.